everyone. This is Carnegie Politica Podcast. My name is Alexander Gabuyev. I'm a senior fellow and the host. And today we're going to talk about the military dimension of crisis that involves Russia, Ukraine, and the collective West. What do we expect to happen on the battlefield in the next several months? We're going to discuss with RAND Corporation senior scholar Dara Masico.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And with Mark Galliotti, who is director at Mayak Intelligence. Glad to have you, Mark.
Good to be here.
The war is about to have its first anniversary. Unfortunately, the terror is still unfolding, and it looks like it's going to be a protracted long conflict. But we have a news that the West now has forged a coalition to supply Ukraine with modern battle tanks and with multiple types of weapons that Ukraine might need to reclaim its territory and launch a successful counteroffensive. So Dara, I think that there was a lot of push and pull on this political discussion about delivering the tanks. And then people were trying to press German Chancellor Scholz to send in the tanks. There were some objections by the chancellery, but ultimately a consensus was reached. President Biden said that he will send Abrams tanks at some distant point in the future. And then Germany greenlighted the ability of other countries that have Leopard tanks to send them to Ukraine and also will send its own 14 Leopard tanks. So at the end, we might have about 80 Leopards committed and maybe more coming. How impactful is that for the future trajectory of what we're going to see in the battlefield?
Well, so I don't always follow the diplomatic side of these discussions very closely, but it seems like there was quite a lot of activity behind the scenes to reach some consensus about this issue. And so it seems like they've gotten past that, and now it's on to the next phase. In terms of what these tanks might do for the battlefield, tanks don't just operate in isolation. There have to be many different elements to make them successful and to enhance their characteristics, whether that's training, and whether that's planning them in combined arms formations, whether that's having some type of long-range artillery support or even air support to really make them effective. So introducing these things into the battlefield, the Ukrainians have shown an ability to absorb rapidly and take it on board. I don't know how they're going to choose to use them, whether it's allowing them to take the tanks they already have, which are Soviet in origin, and putting them forward more and keeping the Western ones back as a reserve, or if they want to commit new ones to the front. I don't know that yet. In terms of what the numbers mean, it's not an insignificant number. This will allow them to do some limited offensives to...
Not insignificant, you mean 80 that we more or less have committed? Because General Zelensky said that they need between 100 and 300. And like the 300 right. was the estimate that right. he was mentioning as something that Ukraine really needs to be successful.
Right. And that number, I think that larger number is more reflective of a larger push, you know, to get them out of an entire region, you know, whether that's Kherson or Zaporizhia, you know, you really need that level of armor. The number that they have is significant, but it will only, I think, go so far in terms of what they can do. How might Russia respond to it? Russia's going to look at this in very mathematical ways. They're going to look at it in terms of correlation of forces. They're going to look at combat potentials, and they're going to make some adjustments before these things come into play.
Mark, why did the political part of the discussion take so long? The war lasts for about a year. I remember Ukrainians calling for modern Western battle tanks as early as last summer in the public. And that's been part of the Rammstein discussions all the time. Why did it take so long to reach consensus?
I think we've got to realize that there's several forces at work here. One of them is absolutely divisions within the West. I mean, on the one hand, it's been astonishing just how unified the West has been in supporting Ukraine. But on the other, we shouldn't pretend that there haven't been absolutely quite so deep divisions, particularly within Europe, between, let's say, a country like Poland, that has a much more maximalist approach, and countries such as Germany and France, for that matter, which are more concerned about the need to sort of essentially emphasize a political solution rather than just simply thinking this can be won on the battlefield, full stop. So that's the first reason. The second one is, again, something that really people don't like discussing openly, but there is a degree to which actually fine-tuning what kind of kit the Ukrainians are provided is actually one of the very few ways that the West can actually maintain some degree of traction on how the war actually is waged. You know, the mantra is, you know, we're all in for the Ukrainians and the war ends when the Ukrainians say it'll end. That is a convenient political fiction, quite frankly, to allow the West not to get too bogged down in its own internal discussions about what it would like to see and how it would like to see the war end. But, you know, let's be honest, that is what's happening. It is not that the West does not have interests. And so I think there's been a degree to which, on the one hand, it's just been pragmatism. We should note, this is not the first time tanks have gone to Ukraine. It's the first time that Western sort of main battle tanks have, but Czech Republic and Poland and other former Warsaw Pact countries have been providing modernized Soviet era kit beforehand. So, you know, that, because that was easy. And it was easy for then the Ukrainians to use it and such like. But the point is that I think the decision to hold back so long on the kind of big, modern, effective Western built tanks was in part precisely because of a concern, frankly, that the Ukrainians would then use them too quickly to, for example, make a drive against Crimea, which is something that many Western capitals are really quite worried about, because the sense that might actually push Putin into some kind of escalation. So, you know, I think it reflects both the needs of the battlefield, the fact that, you know, that this is the year which is likely to see the Ukrainians trying to sort of batter their way through Russian defensive lines rather than just simply preventing the Russians from making further expansion, as much of 2022 was about. But it's also, I think, reflects sort of a constant, frankly, political struggle between Kyiv and the West. Kyiv constantly pushing. You know, it's quite striking that now with the decision on tanks, there's now the, well, that's great, but what about F-16 fighter jets? So, you know, Kyiv will understandably be pushing at every point, and the West, conversely, is trying to actually sort of manage the war through managing the pipeline of supplies that is going to the Ukrainians.
To me, the announcement of President Biden that the Abrams tanks will be there, but they will be produced for Ukraine, not taken from the existing stockpiles of the U.S. military. And of course, the armor is different. So you need to take some armor out that you don't want the Russians to have their hands on if one of the Abrams tanks is captured on the battlefield in Ukraine. It doesn't look like the U.S. wants to repurchase some of the Abrams tanks that Egypt or other countries in the Middle East have. So it looks like the American tanks will arrive many months down the line, if not years. And that looks like a pretty extended commitment out there. So with that in mind, do you think, Dara, that the Pentagon and the coalition is there for kind of this long-term support for Ukraine? And then is there thinking of what kind of capabilities Ukrainian needs in which realistic time frame?
So I think there's different kinds of deliveries going on different timelines, and that makes sense in some ways. You don't want to have gaps in deliveries, so you want to plan out phased deliveries when certain batches of tanks will arrive and whatnot. The issue is, and I understand it, because right now it's sort of a survival game. It's what does everybody have to commit to this? It's creating this kitchen sink effect for Ukrainian logisticians, where there's so many different kinds of equipment that they're trying to maintain in real time under very difficult circumstances. Eventually, there needs to be a long-term strategy. And so I don't know, and that strategy really should be already in place right now. So I don't know if the Abrams is the leading edge of that or not. You know, there's a plan to transition Ukraine in the long term to Western equipment. It makes sense because clearly working through Russia and acquiring arms that way is not going to be an option anymore. So I don't know that we're there yet, but this may be the leading edge of that transition.
And that will also require a lot of training. We have some news that the Ukrainians have been trained how to operate Leopards as early as last summer, but probably there needs to be more training done given the amount of equipment arriving. What do you make of the conversation that parts of the dynamics that we see on the battlefield when it comes to the Russian forces is a preparation for a major offensive that aims to preempt the delivery of tanks and other parts of Western equipment, that the Russians want to make a decisive move to claim more territory and keep Ukraine down?
Yeah, so I think that there was a debate about the future direction of the offensive. And I think that was playing out in December and January. And that's why we saw the big leadership changes that we saw. So if you think about it, when Surovikin was in command of the operation, he seemed to be focused on stopping the bleeding, stopping the damage, and setting into the defensive. And in those respects, he has performed better than other commanders have. And yet he was moved out of the top spot. So I don't know if that is a repudiation of the approach, and the Kremlin wants something more offensive, more forward, more territory. Right now, the pieces of evidence that would support that thesis, there are reports in the last couple of days that things are picking up now in Zaporizhia. There are rumors that all of the Russians that were being trained in Belarus are now starting to decamp and may be committed somewhere else. So I definitely think there is a potential from Russia's perspective in the near term. It benefits them to try to make progress before new capabilities are introduced.
Let's spend some time on the changes in the leadership of the Russian military effort in Ukraine, because that's really interesting. It has the operational military element in this, but it obviously have some palace struggle element as well, because now this war is an organizing principle of Russian foreign policy and of Russian domestic politics as well. And those who want to be powerful in the system really want to have an impact on this war. And then we've seen that there was a lot of criticism towards General Gerasimov and Minister Shoigu from people like Evgeny Prigozhin or Ramzan Kadyrov, and they endorsed General Surovikin. And yet, Mr. Putin made an ultimate decision now to put General Gerasimov in charge, the general who most likely designed the initial plan of the campaign, which we know failed miserably. What do you make of this, Mark?
Yeah, there's always the danger of, given that this is an information scarce system, that we end up, or people end up, creating all kinds of sort of grand theories about what's what. I mean, I think in some ways, it may even be a little bit simpler than it looks, in that, I mean, I don't really believe that people like Prigozhin or Kadyrov have a kind of weight within the system that their complaints really matter. I think they're symptoms more than they are initiators. But on the other hand, I think it's also clear that, yes, Surovikin's approach, which made a lot of sense militarily, but was deeply unsatisfying politically. I mean, this is the general who, after all, had presided over and probably demanded as price of his appointment the withdrawal from Kherson. In other words, actually, a diminution of Russian holdings, who still hadn't managed to take Bakhmut, which has become this kind of bizarre totemic objective that has very little military value, but just simply is still this the wall on which the Russians continue to hammer themselves. And I think in that context, it may well just simply have been the fact that precisely, you know, Putin wanted action. I mean, we've seen this time and again. You know, his approach to getting things done is to berate or replace the key individual in question. You know, there is no new helicopter engine industry in St. Petersburg. Well, then you publicly call out Trade and Industry Minister Manturov and basically say, get it done in a month, rather than addressing the massive systemic challenges involved. Again, it's just very much this almost this notion of that there is no rampart that Bolsheviks cannot storm, you know, that sense that you find the individual. Now, I mean, in that context, if you're unhappy with Surovikin, who, let's face it, was hardly a nice man, but on the other hand, was one of the most able officers of his cohort, was regarded as quite likely to be a successor to the chief of the general staff, given that he was a ground forces officer who had then been put in charge of the aerospace forces before returning in this role. Unless you actually really want to burn your best officers, the only way you can really get around that is by bringing in someone who is even more senior, and that essentially means Gerasimov. I think that yes, clearly that there is pressure for victory, and frankly, I think it's almost inevitable that even without any desire to forestall the impact of the arrival of new kit, that the Russians would have been launching spring offensives. You know, what else have they got, these 150,000 or so mobilized reservists being prepared for, if not to actually try and do something with them? But yes, it does mean that therefore I think the imperative on the Russians to launch some kind of offensive is driven both by the military realities of the battlefield, in that precisely you try and make your advances now before you're facing Leopards and the like, and perhaps more importantly, all the non-tank equipment that's being provided. And then there's also the political imperative, which is just frankly pleasing the boss, which, you know, is the other organizing principle of every other aspect of Russian politics and society.
But wouldn't be with 150,000 mobics who are now being trained with all of the equipment that's brought from storage, and we see all the time former President Medvedev, who is now Putin's deputy in charge of the military-industrial complex, touring various factories and just projecting this scary image he tries to project. Wouldn't holding the lines and fortifying them, something that Suravikin was doing, creating this defensive lines and thinking that, oh, the offensive side will have much bigger amount of casualties, so bringing these people to hold the lines and wait Ukrainians out and hope that the support for Ukraine will dwindle, and then the Russian campaign to terrorize Ukrainian energy infrastructure will deliver, and then ultimately holding what you have is a better way to assure victory. Wouldn't that be logical, Dara? Am I missing something?
No, that's the trap, because that is the logical thing to do, given the status of the force. The force is really damaged right now, and they're bringing in these mobics, and they've stabilized the lines. They've built multiple networks of trenches and defensive positions. They've even augmented that with civilian capabilities to dig faster. I mean, it's really quite a lot of work that's been going on to set the terrain in the areas that they hold. And I guess what I'm scratching my head about is, what additional territory do they believe that they need, and do they believe that they can actually take it? Is it the political boundaries of Donetsk? Is it taking another swing at Kharkiv to try to have all of the East together? I don't know. The big unresolved question for me still is, what are they doing with those mobics? Are they training them as armored units and pulling, BMPs, BTRs, and tanks from storage? Or are they training them in infantry roles? Because infantry roles means I'm going to occupy. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to occupy and I'm going to rotate people, and that's what I'm going to do. If there was evidence that they were training them as armored units, not just the stuff in Belarus, but also back in Russia, to me, that tells me that they're going to try another offensive. The issue, though, that I have with putting Gerasimov back in the hot seat for this is, presumably he was the architect for what they did. What would cause me to have a lot of confidence that he's going to be able to design something realistic this time? I don't know. I don't think that he's the person for the job. But that, again, as we've talked about, loyalty, other political concerns are also very important factors, if not more important factors.
Mark, General Gerasimov looks like somebody who survived the system for quite some time. You are somebody who coined the term Gerasimov doctrine, which was misinterpreted all the time. Why is this guy somebody who has spent so much time with President Putin as his most senior uniformed commander? Because the ministers of defense, starting from Surdykov and actually Sergei Ivanov before that, are not really from the military.
Well, yes. I mean, this is really, first of all, the usual division of labor within the well, first Soviet and now Russian system, is the idea that the Minister of Defense is essentially a politician whose job is more than anything else to ensure that the armed forces are built up and they get their budgets and they get their relevant equipment and so forth. Once war happens, it's the top soldier, Chief of the General Staff, who in some ways becomes a much more crucial figure. Now, look, Gerasimov, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, in some ways, it's perhaps a trivial point to make, but, you know, he looks like Central Casting's notion of the tough Russian general, this sort of granite-faced, unsmiling troll figure. And therefore, understandably, he becomes something of a sort of demonic figure in the West. But likewise, I mean, I think it is clear that he's been quite good at reconciling the two key roles of the Chief of the General Staff, which is on the one hand, shall we say, the trade union shop steward of the military, there to present the interests of the military and above all the high command, the other generals, to the political leadership, but also to be the foreman, to be the person who brings the rules of the top leadership and imposes it upon the high command. And I think that won him a great deal of trust from Putin, because precisely that's how Putin expects his underlings to be, which is, you know, self-interested, shall we say, both personally and institutionally, and yet ultimately that they will do their job, be loyal, be obedient, offer no challenge, and apparently seem to accomplish the missions they've set forth. Now, exactly, depending on what role Gerasimov may have played in the planning of the initial attack, one would think that to have been tarnished, but in some ways, so many people come out badly from that initial attack that I think, you know, everyone has had an interest in collectively creating the consensual illusion that actually it was all, frankly, NATO's fault. And in some ways, almost it was a trap in which they were led rather than anything else. Absolute nonsense, but very, very convenient nonsense. So Gerasimov himself, I mean, after all, this is the man who has been had the longest tenure of any post-Soviet chief of the general staff, who was probably actually coming close to his retirement point. But again, that will probably sort of coincide with the change of the defense minister. Given that at the best of times, Putin doesn't like churn in the top leadership. He holds on to people, frankly, longer than they would often like to be held on to. Just ask Foreign Minister Lavrov. But particularly in actually a time of war, in some ways it would be very disruptive to change your defense minister and your chief of the general staff. So in some ways these people are for the moment stuck there. So Putin is going to work with what he's got. He's going to work with who he trusts. And their actual competence probably takes second place to that.
It's interesting because on the kind of more operational level, we've seen a lot of these changes with General Lapin first promoted and then moved to another role, then promotion of Surovikin, and then his technical demotion because Gerasimov was put on top of that. And it will be very interesting where the line is that the boss decides that he needs to change an entire crew. But then, Dara, do we know if Russia really has some miraculously capable military leaders that are not visible? They're sitting somewhere in Tomsk, maybe, and could do miracles in terms of kind of operating the manpower and the toolkit that Russia's got in a much more competent way.
Well, I think there's a lot of variability among the officers at lower levels. I'm sure there's ones that have performed better than others. One that comes to mind was Teplinsky. Teplinsky was down in the south. He was down in Kherson. Teplinsky's very popular among the VDV. And in a way that I haven't seen recently in terms of somewhat of his rank. And so he's been moved. He's been shuffled. Again, not for anything that I can see him being relieved for cause or anything like that. So I just think that there's some intriguing politics going around. And when I think about, you know, I just wanted to reflect on Mark's comment. I mean, that is how Putin thinks. You know, he doesn't like to change people. He doesn't want to change things in the middle of a war. But then I try to square that with under Gerasimov's command, a majority of the Russia's professional army has been lost. And is it not worse to keep someone like that in the job than to move them. But, you know, that's me thinking like an American here. And so I shouldn't do that.
My problem is that it's not clear that you have better generals. So it looks like people are more or less of the same quality. Some are somewhat better and somewhat more popular. Some are less popular. But that's a kind of group that's more or less uniform. And then comes the trust and the relationship with the great leader that Mark talked about. Putin not only keeps people because they are wildly competent, like he keeps Elvira Nabiullina at the helm of the Bank of Russia, but he keeps a lot of people who are mediocre, not necessarily super competent, but because he's used to them, he knows them very well. He doesn't need to manage this new set of relationships between, for example, his foreign policy assistant Ushakov and Minister Lavrov, because they've been this team for around 10 plus years.
And, you know, when I think back on, you know, the last 10 years of Gerasimov's leadership of the military, we've seen two operations from him before. We saw the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014. We saw what they did in Syria. And it seems to follow something that he once advocated quite strongly for, which was something called the strategy of limited action, which was you pick limited political objectives and you make a tailored force designed for those limited objectives. You don't strain yourself and risk operational or strategic failure. He talked about this not that long ago. and then you have Operation Z, and it's like a complete departure. And there's a few reasons for that. And maybe we could talk about that, since Mark, you've done so much great work on all these dynamics between the Russian intelligence services. There was a lot of interference, I must assume, in the war planning. Either that came from the Kremlin demanding objectives that the military couldn't deliver on, or it was based on assumptions coming from the intel services that permeated the planning. But, you know, when it was really all unraveling last spring, I just remember thinking to myself, this is so alien from how Gerasimov has planned previous operations under his watch. I want to know how many cooks are in the kitchen exactly.
Yeah, I think it's very striking the degree to which up to February, we felt we had a pretty good sense of how the Russian high command not just thought about war, but actually planned it, you know, the different steps, how they, you know, assess the different types of conflict, you know, regional wars and such like, you know, all of this thing we had studied, because it's still a military with a very intellectual approach that feels the need to have thick journals full of learned articles and a military doctrine and everything else. And then this war comes along that basically breaks every rule. And, you know, again, it's very hard not to conclude. And obviously we won't really know until someday when we get the inside access. But exactly, it's very hard not to conclude that precisely the only force that can truly, you know, make them break all those rules is the boss, the commander-in-chief. And precisely, you know, so many different assumptions that permeated it about the fact that the Ukrainians were not going to fight, that they were largely going to welcome the Russians, that this was really going to be about pacification rather than conquest, and that's why you need lots of Rosgvardia to basically put down riots, who then found themselves suddenly in the midst of vicious mechanized brawls for which they're neither trained nor equipped. I mean, again, this is the interesting thing, that actually this is precisely not how the Russians are meant to fight wars. And yet you've now got people like Gerasimov stuck with this. And, you know, one of the many sins that accumulate on, you know, his and Shoigu's shoulders is precisely that there must have been all kinds of points during the initial run-up when they full well knew that this was not actually being based on, you know, real assessments of the challenge. But no one, and I can understand why in that context, but that doesn't excuse it. No one was willing to say, Vladimir Vladimirovich, this is not actually going to work.
So now we might enter yet another phase where some fateful decisions are taken, not because the military believes that these are good decisions, but just because the boss wants them. So very final question, I first go to Dara and then to Mark, and it's the same question. When do you think that we might have some clarity of the future trajectory of the war? Is it June? Is it some other month? When will things become somewhat more clear that we have a kind of 6 month outlook?
Well, I think with the shuffling in command, I think that the chances that the Russians try to rush and do an offensive before they're ready has gone up. I think right now where we're seeing is probing operations down in the south. So we are, you know, prediction has proven to be elusive in this conflict, but I think that Russia is not going to wait until the midsummer to do this. I think it might be the late spring they might start. I did note that Shoigu made a reference to something called Zapad 23. That's an out-of-cycle Zapad. And so I don't know if that means bringing in more forces into Belarus in the summer and then trying to do that again. That's a working theory, a low-confidence assessment. But I think we need to be prepared for a push that, again, the Russian military is not prepared for based on this cast of characters now in charge.
Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would agree with Dara that I think that the Russians are likely to, again, move before they're properly ready and probably move before they really know quite what they're moving about. That said, though, and, you know, I'm acutely conscious that I'm not actually going to really answer your question. But I mean, that said, my feeling is that we will know quite soon that the Russians, shall we say, are not going to be successful. But that is not the same as saying that the Russians are losing or that the Ukrainians are going to be successful. I mean, again, ultimately, you know, Russia still has considerable latent power. This 150,000 Mobiks, they're not good troops. They're not well equipped or whatever. But, you know, stick them in trenches and they still have some degree of capacity to foil Ukraine's sort of chances. You know, one always underestimates the Russians just as one always overestimates the Russians at our peril. So my view is that I can't give you an answer for when we'll, as it were, know who's going to win and when. But on the other hand, I suspect we will quite soon know whether or not, and my own expectation is not, that the Russians' attempt to try and reopen the war to their advantage is going to have any success.
Chilling and pretty sobering. Thank you so much, Dara Massico with RAND and Mark Galeotti with Mayak Intelligence.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.